Well, welcome to a special 1 hour after hours. I'll be back on the air regularly the week after next. But it's my real pleasure to have in here my longtime friend, historian and producer and writer and presenter and all sorts of things, Paul DiRica. He's head of exhibitions at the Chicago History Museum. And an old friend of mine who I haven't seen in a long time, Jeffrey Thomas, who, among many things, tells me that some friend of his told him to say hi to me because I used to put his wife's, not Jeffrey's, but this other friend's wife's, in inkwells in school. I'm going to have to debate that for a second now that I
That's
think
fine.
About it. I don't think I'm that old that we had inkwells at LaSalle Grammar School, but, you know, who knows?
Right.
Who knows? Welcome. Welcome to the show. We're going to spend this whole hour talking about, and this is really exciting, Paul and Jeffrey. Hey, the gang's all here. Chicago Barn Dance Revival is reviving, and it's a live radio show that's going to explore 100 years of country music in Chicago. There are many, many people, Paul DiRica, who will be flabbergasted to know that country music was once a big deal here. A big deal here before, you know, Dolly Parton and Beyonce.
You're right, and I think it's a part of the city's history that should be better known than it is. I mean, I could say, I think somewhat reasonably, that without Chicago and the WLS Barn Dance 100 years ago, there wouldn't be a Nashville and a Grand Ole Opry as we know them today.
Yeah,
this really is where the kind of genre of music emerged, and someone who's written it at great length about it recently is Mark Guarino in his book Country and Midwestern, which is a really good
It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, history.
It's a wonderful book. The revelations in that book were about the country music scene here. You know, at one point thought, oh my God, it's all these weird uptown bars where I'd get killed if I walked in there when I was 18 years old, and I did anyway. But what's the seed of you love history, and you love doing presentations. What's the seed of this particular one?
Well, I'm always, you know, drawn to stories from Chicago's past that, you know, we continue to kind of feel the effects of in the present, but perhaps we don't know as well as we should. And that's certainly the case with the WLS Barn Dance. And what really intrigued me about it is just how popular it was and how long it was on the air. And yet today, what people think about is they think about the Grand Ole Opry, they think about Nashville. And so how can we kind of share this rich history with our fellow Chicagoans? And also, there are so many great artists still in the city today performing. How can we kind of highlight their work? And so the whole premise behind the event is, what if we imagined a world where the barn dance never went off the air?
If you look back in
the past, you can find they had 10th anniversary episodes, they had 20th anniversary episodes. So what would a 100th anniversary episode look like in 2024? And so that was kind of our starting point.
And Jeffrey, what did you know about the barn dance before Paul twisted your arm and said, help me?
I had first learned of the barn dance from my neighbor, who his father, Lester Shine, was the last bass player of the show. And talking with my neighbor, I learned a lot about what the barn dance was just through him and his stories. And the stories that I heard about the barn dance were just wonderful insider kind of things that he remembered as a child growing up here, seeing his father working these gigs Saturday night. And he would tell me stories like, after the show, all of the musicians would go over to their house and just play poker and sit around the kitchen table and just, you know, talk like musicians do and just play some poker.
And smoke and drink.
He knew that his dad did well when he woke up the next day and there was a pile of quarters for him and his brother to go to the ice cream store and get some ice cream. Shout out to Fred Shine.
One of the things about the barn dance, it was once called at some point the nation's commercial heartbeat of country music. It was started by Sears Roebuck, WLS, their station being call letters standing for world's largest store. This was a commercial endeavor, but marvelously, not as kind of grotesquely commercial as things that we see today, do you think? I mean, it was really meant to entertain and enliven a vast audience.
it made perfect sense for WLS to create a show like this because, you know, they were really kind of focusing on listeners out in rural communities. And particularly, you know, 1924, when it first goes on the air, not only are they trying to get listeners from their station, but they're trying to get people to purchase radio sets from the Sears Roebuck catalog. And so they needed to create content for that people would want to tune in and listen to. And so it was a nice sort of symbiotic relationship that formed there. But what I don't think they anticipated when they premiered The Barn Dance, and it's really great too, because the whole way the show came about, the station had been on the air for about a week, and it had been playing like what a lot of radio stations in the era were playing. So you had mostly classical music and then opera.
Sure.
But they decided on Saturday night they were going to try something different, and I actually looked and I found the radio listing for that day, April 19th, 1924, in the Tribune, when they'd list the radio programs. Mm. And all it says is old-time fiddle music, 8 p.m. And they had to actually go out and find someone who could come into the station and play. And the response was so great. And back in that era, you know, you could send telegrams into the station. And so they started getting all of these telegrams from people saying how much they were enjoying the music. And the show kind of grew out of that. And where these telegrams were coming from is many of them were coming from the city. So my point is what they didn't anticipate is that there would be such a response to this, not just out in rural communities that the program was going out to, but also locally here in Chicago, because you had so many transplants.
Well, because they had come here from places.
Exactly.
I mean, that's when I mentioned these you know, the rugged uptown bars. I mean, that's where people came for work.
Right.
It's not the great migration we know of African Americans, but it was a migration nonetheless.
Right.
We'll take a break. We'll come back and continue on with these gentlemen, Paul DeRica and Jeffrey Thomas, and go to hideoutchicago.com to get your tickets. It takes place two shows on Saturday, April 20th. Welcome back. We're talking with Paul DeRica and Jeffrey Thomas about, hey, the gang's all here, a Chicago Barn Dance live radio show exploring 100 years of country music in the city. It is almost, and I don't know how you're going to do the show, but someone's going to have to talk about what it was like for a 50,000-watt blowtorch of a radio station that was reaching people, many of whom had never heard a radio before, many of whom had never had any kind of entertainment in their homes except whatever they might be able to do. Yeah, that's a altering thing, don't you think, Paul? I mean, it alters the way they feel.
Very much so. I mean, what it allows, I mean, it really kind of does allow country music to sort of emerge as a genre. And Mark writes about this at great length in his book. I mean, what you'd have at the time is you'd have, you know, what would be called rural music, or might be called more pejoratively
hillbilly music
or mountain music. But, you know, what the Barn Dance showed is that people living both in cities and out in the country could connect with it, have these kind of shared experiences. And then it became a commercially viable form of music. And it also became something that people came together to see, because the Barn Dance moves out of the studio in the early 1930s.
Right,
and it moves into the 8th Street Theater.
8th Street,
and they start doing, on Saturday night, something very similar to what we're going to do, which is they do two live performances. And one is kind of broadcast more locally, and then one is broadcast more nationally. But the, you know, the 8th Street Theater had a capacity of about 1,200 people, and it was selling out, like, every Saturday for both shows.
Two shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there were four-and-a-half-hour broadcasts where, and I've pulled this from my own modest research, a medley of barn dance callers, instrumentalists, barbershop quartets, and comedians.
Mm. Right.
Acts needing to rest their voices and fingers, you'll appreciate this, Jeffrey, had a designated comedian who riffed on proverbial encounter with a city slicker and a country bumpkin. I'm charmed by this. When you get this idea, Paul DeRica, and you call your friend Jeffrey and say, hey, I've got this idea, I must tell you that this is a very ambitious and not as difficult, it seems, to be a chef or something, but putting this together is daunting.
Well, we've been working on this project for over a year at this point. We like to take a lot of time to do the research, do the planning, and bring together a good group of performers. And Jeff was really instrumental in that. I think right away he got the idea that we're not going back to 1924. We're in 2024, but we're going to kind of evoke what the Barn Dance is. And like what you were just saying, we're going to have a range of musical performers. We have some actors, you know, doing the bits in between.
Fantastic.
We have some historians like Mark and also Francesca Royster on hand to provide the historical context. And I don't know, Jeff, do you want to talk a little bit about kind of what led to your choice of some of the musicians?
It was really it was really this idea that what if this show had never gone off the air?
That's a great idea.
Almost like to create an alternate universe of this particular show. And that's what inspired me and excited me to do it, because I don't come from the country
genre. Right. Yeah.
I'm a music director and a composer of new music. But what excited me was to think about this idea of, okay, if this show continued and all of the artists that I know and I work with contemporary now, would we have at some point even performed on the Barn Dance?
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, one person I found out, I didn't get a list of everybody who's ever performed on the Barn Dance, but Johnny Frigo, who was something of a legendary violinist here, mostly jazz violinist, he was proud to be a violinist on the Barn Dance, called himself a hillbilly violinist. I would think that a lot of people, many of the musicians I know, are not loath at all to explore other genres.
Right.
They find it a challenge, and they find it, you know, intellectually rewarding. Did you find that?
Definitely. Music for me is another language. It's a form of communication.
Yep.
And the dialect of country music is just another thing to explore to help grow my own desire to want to learn this form of communication, music in general. And so when I was building the band, I deliberately looked for musicians not just in the circle of country music, because we have some ringers in there.
Sure.
Justin Brown on the steel guitar, Matt Gandersky on country lead guitar, Lawrence Peters, who's a really big name in our local scene. He's going to be playing the washboard, the electric washboard.
Wow.
So it's not just
a
washboard sound. It's a brand new, unique sound. And with all of those, I thought of outside of the box musicians and younger musicians. Macy Stewart, who's in a great band called Phenom.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to be playing fiddle, but she also plays indie rock and has a wonderful voice. She's performed with jazz players like Ken Vandermark.
Sure.
Also as singers too. I didn't want to go just for regular country singers. And the first person that, and it was just so happens that I was hanging out with my neighbor Fred Shine again.
Yeah.
My other neighbor is Marvin Tate, the poet.
Oh, well,
Marvin Tate.
Sure.
And so when Paul asked me, it was just that weekend I was hanging out with Marvin, and I said, "Hey, Marvin, man, I got this country gig. Would you be interested in being a part of it and singing a song?" "Yeah, man," right away. He said yes. So then it became already a different kind of show.
Sure,
with how I would build this show.
Yeah, there was no arm twisting involved. You were getting all these people who were excited about it.
Exactly.
And wanted to collaborate with you and others. What
right.
about the comedians, Paul? I'm fascinated now with these comedians telling hillbilly and country bumpkin kind of humor. I have not heard in my many travels to Zanies and elsewhere over
right.
the years much of that.
Well, for the more dramatic and comedic parts of the show, I turned to some people that I've worked with a lot over the years, Joe Shupak and Meredith Milliron, and they were able to, and I worked with them on projects that adapted other Chicago media, so we did like new episodes of Studs Place many years ago,
around the
time of the Studs Trickle Centennial, and we worked on a project around the Compass Players, and they come from an improv background, and they're really great performers to engage with these projects because they can really kind of respond in the moment, react to guests and audiences. And so they put together a great cast with Chris Rathjen, who I've worked with a lot on the Studs Place episodes and a Dave Garraway tribute that we did and some other things. Rachel Wilson, who I also worked on those projects with, and Laura McKenzie and Barry Irving. This is the first time that we're working with Barry, and he's going to be the MC for the show.
How great. What's his background?
His background is also, once again, kind of coming from that sort of improv world.
Yeah. I hope you, ladies and gentlemen out there listening, are getting a sense of how exciting this thing sounds. You're unlikely Paul and Jeffrey, to have many people walking in. You may have some. You may have a few who walk in and go, I remember listening to this when I was a young man. I think it would be incredibly cool to get their reactions.
Oh, yeah.
Because it stopped on LS in around 1960.
Right.
Then this fabulous station stole it or resurrected it and ran it for
about a decade.
A decade until maybe. I'd love to think that it stopped during the Democratic convention when it was here. But it is – the great thing about it is it can take that label of homespun, which is not an unpleasant notion for me. But it also – the creative sparks that went on at this thing are what really intrigued me. You too? It must.
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating. And the people whose careers kind of emerged out of it, because it did have this sort of – you know, it was a little bit almost like a variety show in some ways.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And so some really major artists emerged from the barn dance, Gene Autry probably being the most prominent.
Tell that story.
Yeah. Well, just that he, you know, that's where, I mean, today, of course, you know, we think of like breaking in at on a program like the Grand Ole Opry. But I mean, in that era, the barn dance was the show to be on. And that's really kind of where he got his start. And he became so popular that he ended up eventually negotiating a completely new contract for himself at a much higher rate, where he was a featured player.
My idiotic research, Gene Autry's transformation was similar. Autry was hired by WLS Morning Show in 1931, but even though Autry wore street clothes, he began bringing on with flourishes such as, "I see a cowboy riding. Here he comes. It's our own Gene Autry."
Right.
And Gene Autry became one of the wealthiest country-related performers ever.
Wealthy enough to own a baseball team.
Yes, indeed. I hear he was a jerk, though. But he wasn't about to do anything good to me. When we come back after the news, we'll talk more with Paul and Jeffrey about the event. You can easily go to Hideout Chicago. I think it's Hideout Chicago, right? Hideoutchicago.com and get tickets. And tickets are so reasonable, in advance and 25 at the door, which means most of the 100-some performers will be making no money, but they're doing this for the love of the thing. And Tim Tutton will just give them his money. That's the thing to do.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for.
And I'm thinking that maybe we can ask Jeffrey to play a song for you.
All right.
Oh, okay.
Because he has a guitar here.
I brought one.
He's mesmerized by the view out the window.
I can't help it.
And who isn't? Who isn't? So stay tuned. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Chicago Barn Dance, premiered on April 19, 1924, and on this April 20th, it is coming back. And it's there are two shows, right, Paul? Describe this afternoon at the Hideout.
So on Saturday, April 20th, we're going to do an early show at 5:30, and that show currently sold out, but we expect we're going to release some more tickets on April 15th. In between, we're going to do a square dance at 7. Square dance is free, and it's being led by Paul Collins. Paul Collins has been leading square dances since he was a teenager. He actually remembers going with his grandfather to see the barn dance at the 8th Street Theater.
Wow.
And then his parents, he grew up on the South Side, and his parents were avid square dancers, and so he started calling dances while still an adolescent. And he later went on to teach dance at the Old Town School of Folk Music and be involved with the University of Chicago Folk Festival and events like that. And then at 8:30 p.m., there'll be our evening show. The two shows are 60-minute each, so they're not like the original barn dance that could run for 4 hours. But we wanted to do it on a Saturday like they used to do it, and we wanted to have the two shows. And you know, we tried to keep ticket costs really low.
You have done that.
Yep. But we do have a lot of artists involved, so there is a chance for both the early and late show to buy what we're calling hayloft tickets. And there's just 6 of these tickets. But if you purchase them, you and a guest get to sit at an original table from the Double R, which was...
R downtown,
exactly, where the Sundowners used to play.
Joel Daly, man.
Right?
Joel
Daly. Those tables are at the Hideout. You get to sit at the table. You get a poster designed by Ethan D'Arcoli, the hand-printed poster. You get the centerpiece, and you get a tickets to any other Hideout shows of your choice.
Oh, God.
And you get your name read over the air, thanking you for being a supporter of the event.
And these shows are going to be broadcast.
That's right.
Not on WFMT.
That's correct.
Yeah. Both of them.
Yes, so WFMT is our media partner. What they're actually going to do is they're going to record the two performances mm-hmm. and then edit it down to one show
wow.
that'll air on May 11th.
That's fantastic. You can mm-hmm. also read, ladies and gentlemen, the story mm-hmm. that I'm writing about this and these two fine gentlemen be online Wednesday, and it'll be in print, which is the way I like things, but I'm old-fashioned, next Sunday. Next Sunday.
Wonderful.
Jeffrey, are you in charge of selecting the music?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'm working with the artists. I selected all the artists. I looked in the community here in Chicago, and the artists that inspired me to want to work with on this show. And I tried to find artists that not only helped tell the history of this, but almost perhaps a future of what country is going, where country
yeah,
is going.
Sure.
So, for instance, to speak to the history, we have Girls of the Golden West,
mm-hmm.
which was an original group that performed at the original barn dance, Dolly and Millie, the Girls of the Golden West. And Millie's great niece mm-hmm. is Mary D. Reynolds, artist here in Chicago, who has a new group called Girls of the Golden West. So they're doing an original Girls of the Golden West song called Love Letters, Faded Love Letters. And but we also have some of the newer voices. Andrew Sa is going mm-hmm. to be performing. Nikki Morgan is going to perform. But we also have out of the pocket performers. Marvin Tate and Hawk Nebula is going to be doing his version of Glenn Campbell's Wichita Lineman. We also have.
What are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be back there looking at the musicians.
The shepherd.
Yeah, pointing and waving my hands. And I'm going to play just some rhythm guitar. And also composing an original piece that's going to be one of the artists that I'm really, really excited to work with and blessed to even to be working with is the poet Tara Betts.
Oh, sure. I know Tara.
And Tara has written an original poem for this show.
And you're sending it to music?
And I'm going to underscore it.
Wow.
Yeah, with this ensemble. So I'd like to just play just a little bit of what that's going to be like. I'm not going to...
Krista and Brett have arranged this, and you're okay. All set. You have a stool, right. And you're
I do
good.
Have a stool. I got this mic in front of me. Her poem that she wrote for this show is called The Unpredictable Symphony.
Wow.
Just a taste.
Wow. It reminds me of... You're a great player and a great musician. When I was 12 years old, my mother tried to get me guitar lessons from one of her drinking buddies at the O'Rourke's, and it never worked out, but so I envy you that. We're going to take a little break here, and then we'll come back and talk a little more about the show. And, you know, there's something, Paul, in putting together something like this, fellas, it seems to me, and maybe you do, that at the end of it, you go, wow, that was really an incredible amount of fun. Maybe we should do that again. I want to get your take on that thing, because it's just in what you're talking about, the new country sound. Not that the station will give you a new barn dance, but you never know. You never know. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Paul DiRica and Jeffrey Thomas to talk about, hey, the gangs all here, Chicago barn dance are doing... It's basically the resurrection of the rebirth of the Chicago Barn Dance, which was which was among the most popular radio endeavors in the history of this very radio-centric town. I mean, this was the town for a long time. You had 50,000-watt stations here. You know, and, you know, this very station, you know, live report from the Scopes monkey trial, for goodness
right.
sake.
Yeah.
Where's that innovation now? Where's it?
Well, that, you know, I mean, we're celebrating the centennial of the WLS Barn Dance, but 1924 is a kind of pivotal year for WGN as well.
Sure.
Because that's when it takes over the station that was at the Edgewater Beach Hotel.
Exactly, exactly.
And really kind of boosts its profile.
Yeah, it's amazing to think. It is amazing to think, and to me, wonderful to think of how unbelievably popular radio was when there was no real alternative.
Right.
How people had to use their imaginations and how they had to say, you know, what does this one person look like? What does this person do? I suppose in part, and I don't know people, there's still some good things on the radio, I suppose, but nothing, not, this barn dance is just an amazing phenomenon. I hope I can catch it correctly in print to just tell people who knew nothing about it before. It's a phenomenon, is mm-hmm. I think. You too?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the fact that it just was on the air from 1924 all the way up until the late 60s, and the fact that it was able to kind of change over time and kind of, you know, adapt to what was going on in the media landscape. And then it was willing to take risks as well. It's funny when you think about a show that was playing what it considered traditional music, that it was willing to kind of do crazy things. So like in the 1933 Century of Progress World's Fair.
Yeah, right.
The entire week, WLS was broadcasting from, or what was called Farmers Week. That whole entire week they were broadcasting from the World's Fair, and then they did a performance of the Barn Dance on that Saturday that had tens of thousands of people.
Right. Yeah,
and they would do one episode of the Barn Dance they broadcast from like an airplane. It was just like crazy stunts like that, right?
Yeah.
That you wouldn't think about when you're thinking about, you know, music that was coming from a rural places.
Well, also, this was broadcast in the face of unbelievable world and national events. It starts in the Roaring Twenties, when many people would go, and not everybody was hanging out with Scott and Zelda, but it infused and gave entertainment to people who were never going to go to the Stork Club or the Algonquin. And then it's dealing with the Depression.
Right.
Right.
And then a war. And then I think one of the reasons it probably faded away, Paul, and let me know what you two guys think, is the incredible prosperity that came in the wake of World War II and the move to the suburbs and you know, your radio in your car, you're not gathered at home, and that had to play some part in it.
That played a part, I think. You know, television
TV,
and its emergence played a part, and it tried to transition to TV with limited success. And I think
How did they try that?
There was a very early televised version of the Barn Dance that ran in 1949.
Wow.
What is ABC today? And then they attempted again, too, on WGN as well. But they basically were just sort of televising the live performances of the radio show.
Gotcha.
There wasn't a lot of, like, additional sort of production that was added to it. And I would say that, you know, the other big thing, and when you actually look at the history of the radio station WLS that occurs, of course, is there's a new dominant genre that emerges post-war, and that becomes rock and roll.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And figures who, you know, could kind of bridge those genres. I mean, even like, I mean, Elvis for somebody.
Yeah, Elvis,
I mean, they
should
become,
have called himself a hillbilly singer.
Right, yeah.
If
but no, but that's what
singer,
we think
right?
of him as the king of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the change that happens. And you know, the barn dance performers begin to feel very, you know, old hat in some ways.
You could almost imagine the barn dance, had it kept going, that rock and roll would have been included with
right.
it
and
exactly. grown from it and had it grown. But I would also probably also put WSM's Grand Ole Opry as another reason why the barn dance probably started to fade away with the rise of what they were doing in Nashville.
Well, you head down in Nashville, you had, you know, commercially minded entrepreneurs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that whoever were the people behind Barn Dance were altruistic. They wanted to make money, too. But,
right.
But I think once Grand Ole Opry in Nashville got onto this, they said, well, we can print money.
And they made it their specialty. I mean, you mentioned both the kind of rich radio landscape that existed here in Chicago, but also the rich music landscape as well. I mean, Nashville staked out the claim to country music, but here in Chicago, I mean, you had blues, you had jazz, you had, mm-hmm. I mean, you had everything else.
Yeah.
So you didn't necessarily need it to be the center of country music.
But also, they didn't have the kind of entrepreneur who's, you know, right. I think they've done a lousy job of making these, you know, you'll get people coming here from out of town going, yeah, you play the blues here, but they've never taken full advantage of that legacy, right. I don't think. Do you?
No. There's so much more that can be done here around those histories.
But what I also love is the fact, and Jeffrey, you were addressing this, the current vitality of the music scene here. These are not all people who have feature stories written about them. They don't have their own TV show. But you, in the middle of this whole scene, will tell me, looking at me right now, when you're not looking out the window.
No, not anymore.
That it is an astonishingly rich scene here, isn't it?
Incredibly inspiring to be a musician here. Because there is so many musicians here that are here making music because they love it. And there is a rich amount of other musicians to just hang out and talk with. The Hideout for me has been a central place of many different kinds of musicians hanging out and talking. Jazz musicians, blues musicians, indie rock musicians, and country. And the Hideout is talked about in Mark Greeno's book being also a center of new country with the...
No question.
You know.
Sure.
But outside of just country, Ken Vandermark had performed out of there. Fred Anderson had his 90th birthday party on the stage there. Mavis Staples did a live recording in that room. And that's why us doing the show in that space makes it special, not only for me, but I think in telling the story about what the Barn Dance is, what all this music is coming from, and why is it, and why it's as eclectic as it is.
You know, one of the things, and we've been talking about this a little off air, as Paul's brought up, is that, okay, this is going to happen on April 20th. It's one day. Then you say, hey, everybody, that was great fun. Yeah. But you are making these creative connections with people.
Yeah.
They're not all becoming your best friends, but you are making creative connections that can grow onward from there. That's really, I think, important.
And that's one of the reasons why we kind of do these sort of events. We want to both, you know, look to the past and draw inspiration from it, but we also are looking to the future as well. And so ideally, this is an opportunity for artists to perhaps work together who wouldn't otherwise, and they can then go on and create something new.
Exactly.
I mean, one of the great things about Chicago history is there's always these kind of like through lines. There's certain figures. We were talking earlier, also off air, about Win Strachey.
Yeah.
Win Strachey appeared on the WLS Barn Dance.
I don't doubt that.
You know, he also helped to go on and establish the Old Town School of Folk Music.
Yeah.
And he was a good friend with Studs Terkel.
And he is the voice of Paul Bunyan and the Museum of Science.
But so he was able to connect all these different communities and worlds. And that's something that I think is special about the city.
Well, you guys, that's why I so admire you, Paul. You know I have for a long time. He works. Day job is at the Chicago History Museum as a exhibitions manager, and Jeffrey Thomas, my new friend, because he's connected me with some woman I abused when we were about 7 years old. The cancel culture is going to come get to me. Go, ladies and gentlemen, once again, go to the Tribune this Wednesday online and next Sunday in print. To read more about this, there are two shows at the Hideout, one at 5:30, one at 8:30, Saturday the 20th. There are all sorts of special deals, as Paul told you, too. Tickets are only $20 in advance, $25 at the door. Go to hideoutchicago.com, and don't tune in here. I don't know what's on next week. They just go dead air. What is it? Oh, we'll have WGN Radio Theater, not starring me, next Sunday. But the Sunday after that, we're back at full strength. Krista Flores, Brett Jackson, thank you, thank you, thank you, Paul DeRica, and Jeffrey Thomas, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
This was fun.
Thanks.